And we're off. And it's Monday at 1 o'clock, and it's time for Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafa, a half-hour weekly examination of ideas and insights that are contained in the Tractate of the Fathers against their historical, against their ideational, against their daily implications. This year, which has been going on for a year and a half already, hard to believe, is brought to you by the Tel Aviv International Synagogue under the inspired leadership of Rabbi Ariel Constantine. And let's get to work. Last week, we first of all, I want to thank a lot of you for your comments from last week's shiur. I was a little bit nervous about raising the possibility that one can best understand the career and the ideas of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus against the background of him being something of a Baal Tshuva, newly religious, or not newly religious in his case, but a person who came from a non-scholarly background and joined the elite of the Pharisees and then of the rabbis in the period after the Temple. And I think I was a little concerned that perhaps people might consider it to be somewhat disrespectful, but I was wrong. I was very happy to receive positive feedback, and I welcome the feedback. It can be critical too. It happens to be last week's was particularly positive. As I mentioned, we're in the midst of a series of Mishnayot, of passages which discuss the students, the major disciples of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the individual who, I think more than anyone else, guaranteed the survival of Judaism in a post- or non-temple world. And we started with Rabbi Eliezer. We talked about their various virtues. And what I'd like to do is to not plow through the Mishnayot one after the other. What I'd like to is continue discussing each personality separately. As it happens, there is a series of Mishnayot that is about to ensue, where the opinions and the adages of each of the five disciples of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai are examined. And what I would like to do is to take one at a time. So today we'll continue talking about Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, and try to collate and integrate his various statements into sort of a Weltanschauung, something of a his world outlook. The following the Mishnah after the Mishnah that we talked about last week, in which Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is described as a plastered cistern who doesn't lose anything, doesn't lose a drop, a person of massive encyclopedic knowledge and a fundamentally conservative personality. The Mishnah continues and says that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai gave homework to all five of his disciples. And on one occasion, he said to them, go out and consider what's the best quality that a person should develop for a righteous, for a pious, for an ethical life. And on another occasion, he said, go and consider and come back to me with your opinion as to what is the what is a way to be, human qualities are to be avoided in order to be able to guarantee a ethical, moral, humane life. On both occasions, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus said he basically focused on the positive and the negative side of the same quality, and that is, he said, the person should have a good eye. Now, that doesn't mean you should have a good aim. You should have a good eye. A good eye guarantees that that's the way to live your life, and a bad eye is what to avoid. Now, we don't exactly know what that means. However, I think it will become clearer when we look at the third Mishnah following these, which actually preserves his, what should we call them, his quintessential or his idiosyncratic, but those sayings or those statements or those ideals which he are particularly associated with him. So, the Mishnah, after talking about a good eye and a bad eye, the Mishnah says, Rabbi Elazar Omer, let the kavod, we'll come back to that in a minute, let the kavod of your friend be as dear to you, as beloved to you, as your own. V'alti noach lichos, don't be easy, don't get angry easily. V'shuv yom echad lefnei mitatcha, you should do tshuva just before you die, or a day before you die. V'havei mitchamem keneged oran shel chachamim, come close as you can and warm yourself before the sages, as if they were a fireplace where a person who is cold can get warmed. And then he has something of a more acerbic comment. Don't get too close to their chotes, their burning embers, to their coals. Shelo tikaveh, because you might get burned. Shenishichatam nishichat shual, when they bite you, it's like when it's as if a fox bites you. Vakitzatan akitzat akrab, and when they strike you, when they also when they bite you, that's the akitsa is what happens when an insect bites you, is that of a scorpion. Ulechishatam lechishat saraf, and when they hiss, it is the hiss of a poisonous snake. V'kol divrehem kegachalei esh, and all of their words are like burning or fiery coals. I will leave that last one for a bit. I would like to coordinate the first three. In other words, what should you cultivate? What's important to do? And that is having a good eye. What should you avoid? And that's having a bad eye. And what should you, what is the first thing? What's the prime directive to you to apply Star Trek imagery here? Is Yihi Chavod Chavercha Chaviv Alecha Kishalach. Let the Chavod of your friend be as beloved or dear to you as your own. First of all, we need to define our terms. What is kavod? Now, it's interesting. The word, I just for funsies, I looked up the word honor. You would say normally say honor, right? The word for honor, and it turned in Wikipedia just for fun, and it turns out this is an English entry in Wikipedia for honor. And I looked up dignity. And there's an English one, English entry for dignity. Interestingly, however, there is no Hebrew Wikipedia entry for honor, but there is for dignity. I'm not interpreting scripture here, but I think it's an important distinction. The word kavod can mean what can mean both. The truth is, the word kavod can mean both honor, as in we give you an award or we'll throw you a dinner, or we'll slobber all over you, and we'll applaud you, and stuff like that. And kavod can also mean dignity. The two words conflate in Hebrew, but they're not the same at all. Honor is a term which, to a significant degree, doesn't really exist in Judaism, or it does in a lot of other places. Honor reflects, this is complicated, but honor reflects a series of norms which pertain to the way people interact and which determine what people can do to each other and what it's always within a certain group. The honor of the nobility, the honor of the church, the honor of the country, the honor of the citizen, stuff like that. And generally speaking, there's a collective piece to it. In other words, there's a code of honor which affects everybody in the group. It's very much a matter of if one individual represents the entire group. So if you violate the honor of a country, for example, if a country, one country, raids, somebody would come and raid, North Carolina. So it wouldn't matter that it was only North Carolina that took the hit. The United States as a whole had its honor impugned, and therefore that would be a casus belli. That would be a reason to go to war. It's a group thing. There are whole societies that are based on this idea of the honor of the group, which is reflected by and expressed by and experienced by all the members of the group. So in tribes, for example, many, many tribes, generally tribes are like this. If one member of a tribe is hurt, then the entire tribe has its honor impugned, and therefore what you have to go do is go and attack and demand payment from from anybody, from some random member of the other tribe, because it's a collective thing. You have in some places, it's a very, very good, today in common, the way we look at it in the West, it's horrific. But if you, if a person acts improperly, as far as the group is concerned, with a woman as part of the group, a daughter or a wife, then, and the wife and the woman has seemed to have dishonored the family. Sometimes she pays with her life, which is a horrific idea. But the idea is, and this is the next piece, next point I want to make, in a society where one's personal honor or one's group honor is more important than anything else, one's very essence and one's very validity depend on honor. Okay, in other words, if I violate the honor of the family and I'm not a member of the family, then it's as if everybody in the family has been dishonored, and their legitimacy, personal legitimacy and their personal credibility, personal right to live has been impugned, and therefore, it's if you killed them, and therefore you deserve to die, or you deserve to pay a very heavy crime penalty. Within the family, if you dishonor the family, then you lose your right to live, because your part of the justification for your life is the honor of the group. The whole idea, by the way, of duels is based on this idea. I mean, what's a duel? A duel is you did something which dishonored me, you insulted me, you hurt my feelings. You showed familiarity to me, which is not appropriate. If I'm a lord, if I'm a noble, and you're a nobody, you're like serf, and you presume to act on the same level as I am, then you have impugned my honor, and you give up. Therefore, you have to pay with your life, or you have to pay a serious price. Honor-shame cultures, and there are many of them still today, put the honor of the individual and the honor of the group way ahead of the life of the individual, because the life of the individual or the life of the group is dependent upon the honor of the group. And again, you can define it. I know it sounds very vague, but the truth of the matter is the exact content of the honor of the group changes from context to context. But Judaism really doesn't have that idea of honor. What the Torah taught is actually to reject that kind of group honor, but rather to work for a different model of how people should integrate, how people should relate to one another, and that is personal responsibility. In other words, the Torah derives the honor, to honor more as dignity, not just the idea of looking for kavod, like having people follow you on Instagram and stuff like that. It does exist, but it's not a value, it's not a high value. For us, kavod is more dignity, and kavod derives from the idea that we are all created in the image of God, and therefore all human beings, not just Jews, all human beings must be respected and must be cared for, and must be considered, because we're all created in the image of God. And if you insult another human being, if you hurt another human being, then you have directly or indirectly insulted the person's maker as well. In other words, every sin, every infraction against another human being is both what we call a mitzvah ben adam makom and a mitzvah ben adam chaviro. In other words, you basically have both committed an infraction both against a human being and against your fellow man or woman, and against God Himself, because God commands that all of us are created in His image, and therefore we are representatives of Him. And at the end of the day, the bottom line of Jewish interpersonal relations is, in fact, this idea that everybody should be treated as if, with the awareness of the fact that they are created in the image of God, that they're all Tzalmei Elokim. Now, so therefore, the proper translation of Kavod in most places, again, you can always find exceptions, but in most places, this is dignity, human dignity. Now, at the same time, that means that what happens if you violate somebody's dignity, if you insult them, if you berate them, if you make them feel badly? So that is a sin. That is a sin. And because that is a sin, you have to make it up to them. Now, sometimes it's a matter of apologies. Sometimes it's a question of... damages, but it's a one-on-one situation. There is no room, and the Torah actually adjudicates all of those cases, so therefore, there's no room for personal vengeance either. Okay. There's one exception to this rule, and that is the idea of Goel Hadam, that individual tribes took responsibility to effect judgment on a person who might have killed a member of the tribe or a member of the family. But that's still, it's not a question of the tribe was hurt by virtue of the fact that a member thereof was murdered, but rather to effect justice. And the Torah works hard to wean people away from that and to bring all cases of criminal torts and justice into the Torah's criminal justice system. Okay. That is a very long way of saying that honor, the way that it's generally understood, is a matter of the identity of a person's worth with the group's sensitivities, and that a person's entire essence is dependent thereon, and therefore if you impugn somebody else's honor, then you can lose your life, or it's as if you killed them. We have a situation, the Torah teaches, personal responsibility. You hurt somebody, yeah, but you're responsible to make up and to make amends, however those amends are going to be. Now, having said, given that whole Chad Gadya, let's go to the Mishnah. Yehi chavod chavercha chaviv alecha kishalach. Let the dignity of your fellow person, or your fellow man, or fellow woman, be as dear to you as your own. What does that mean? So there are a number of different possibilities, and I think the easiest one for us at the moment is that is provided actually by the quality which Rebbe Eliezer said you should strive to develop, or that quality which you should strive to avoid. In other words, a good eye. What is a good eye? Good eye, I think, in this connection means that when you interact with somebody, you should see them. Don't be so caught up with yourself that you're all caught up with what you have to say that you can't see who they are. You can't see how the other person is reacting. You don't measure or consider how your words or your actions might impact on somebody else's feelings. That's what an ayin tova is. It's an open eye. An ayin ra'ah is the same thing as an ayin tsara, meaning being narrow-eyed. Narrow-eyed or evil-eyed means that you either are aggressive towards another person out of selfish motives, or again, you simply don't see somebody. You ignore them. You just let yourself go on and on and on and on and on without realizing, without acknowledging the fact that that the other person was also created in the image of God. So the other person's dignity has to be the dignity of the other person, of another person, has got to be the leading factor in the way that one leads one's life. One can always be sure to worry about oneself, looking out for number one. But to strive to know that you're not supposed to live alone, but to strive to take other people's feelings into consideration, that is a major, major, achievement if one gets to that. Now, it's interesting. There's a wonderful article by a famous sociologist of religion whose name was Peter Berger, who passed away not long ago. Already 51 years ago, he wrote an article called On the Obsolescence of the Concept of Honor. And he then in that article, he points out that the old concept of honor, where if you violate a person's honor or you look at them as cockeyed, that'll lead to a duel and all this other stuff, all that doesn't obtain anymore. This is in general, in contemporary society, he means 50 years ago, people don't really care whether you insult them or not. It's not really, you got to tough it up, and actions speak louder than words, and sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, as my mother used to say. All of that, he says at the time, is not part of Western discourse. I find it very striking that, not so much here in Israel, but from what I understand in certainly in the United States, the opposite is true. That everybody has a very thin skin, and that any insult, any injury, becomes a hanging offense. In other words, it's really striking. The pendulum appears to have actually gone the other way. In other words, now if you say something which is wrong and somebody takes even the slightest offense, then you are, I don't like particularly the word necessarily, but you're canceled. That's the same as an honor-shame culture against which the kind of thing that the Torah worked against. Because, yes, if you hurt somebody, and you can say, I'm sorry, and take responsibility, that's what the Torah says to do, but to say you have no more right to live, you have no right to live, whether it's physically or whether socially or whether it's commercially or whether it's professionally. That's exactly a return to the kind of, we would even say primitive, kind of society that the Torah sort of preached against, where everybody takes responsibility for their actions. And if it turns out that they said something wrong and that they hurt somebody's feelings, they say I'm sorry. And then the Torah demands that if the apology is sincere, then you have to forgive them. And that comes back to Rabbi Elazar as well. Yehi chavod chavercha chaviv alecha mikeshalach. You should put yourself in the other friend, in your friend's place. And yes, when you say something, you would want to be forgiven, and you would want them to forgive you. And you wouldn't want to give up your life or profession. You wouldn't want them to give up your life or profession either. There are limits. There are measured ways of responding to human interaction. Ayin tova, also, by the way, also means to give people the benefit of the doubt. Ayin ra'ah means to be prejudiced and to not give anybody the any credibility, not to believe anybody, to vilify other people. All of these three fundamental statements by Rebbe Elazar all hang together to have a modulated, balanced, reasonable, not crazy way of interacting. And again, it comes down to the question of people being created in the image of God. We do things all the time. People who are faith, we sin all the time, whether it's on purpose, whether it's not on purpose. Generally, it isn't on purpose. And what do? We ask forgiveness. We take responsibility, and then we expect, God promises that he'll forgive us. And we work hard to understand God, even though it might be hard for us. I'm not saying we forgive God, that would be way too much. So that this Rabbi Eliezer's statement is really quite striking, because it is an assertion of the essence of Jewish interpersonal morality. The words were stated in a society, in a Roman society, which was still very much based on honor-shame. And they have, I think, tremendous contemporary implications and valence. And microaggressions and all this other stuff is simply a return to the primitive world of honor-shame. Something perhaps to think about. So, that is for today. We, as always, you please share this. I welcome your comments. This will be up on my YouTube channel. It'll be distributed through my the Facebook page. And send me your comments, send me your ideas, and we will see you next week. Bye.